Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
Hey, everybody, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos, and today on The Breakdown, we are delighted to have with us Congresswoman Karen Bass from Los Angeles. She chairs the Congressional Black Caucus and has been a leading voice on police reform in Washington.
And before going to Congress, she was Speaker of the State Assembly starting in 2008, making her the very first Black woman to lead one house of a state legislature in the United States. And as if that weren't enough, she is said to be on Joe Biden's shortlist for vice president. Lots to talk about. Congresswoman Karen Bass, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thank you for having me on.
We are delighted that you're here. And I want to begin by talking about one of your colleagues who we lost this week, a true giant in the civil rights movement, talking, of course, about John Lewis. What did you learn from him?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it was just such an honor to serve with him. I mean, I've been in Congress 10 years, and whenever I would see Mr. Lewis, you know, he just was always a source of calm, steadfastness. Someone who embraced everyone, even the people he disagreed with. And, you know, without a doubt, out of 535 members of Congress, you know, 100 senators, 435 House members, he was the most respected person. Democrats, Republicans, senators, and House members. And so we're going to do a tribute to him tomorrow evening. And the Congressional Black Caucus will lead it off. But then it will be open to the entire House. And that's something that we don't do often. Usually when we do tributes on the floor, it's kind of one party or the other.
Yeah. And we should say we're taping this a little early. This show will run on Thursday. Congresswoman, I mean, you kind of share that in that quality, I think, with the late John Lewis, which is that you are known for getting along with folks across the aisle. Is that something that you two ever spoke about? And given that you were both leaders in your own right and your own generations around civil rights, like, is that something that you think comes out of that type of movement, that you need to be able to figure out how to sort of build bridges?
Well, absolutely. And what I learned from him is how you can do that, but you need to have that commitment over time. You know, I mean, all of us, especially when we're young, we want change to happen in the next hour. And we want it to be dramatic change. And understanding the patience of history, understanding that change can be slow. And then most important is understanding that change is not permanent. So, you know, I'm sad to say that Mr. Lewis passed away before he saw the Voting Rights Act really restored. And after fighting and almost losing his life for it, seeing it happen, seeing it being reauthorized time and time again by in a bipartisan manner, and then to experience the Supreme Court gutting it and it becoming a very, very hyper-partisan issue. But it just means that we have to take the baton from him. It shows us what our responsibility is now. We have got to finish what he started.
Soon after he died, and his death was announced on Saturday, you tweeted to President Trump, "While the nation mourns the passing of a national hero, please say nothing. Please don't comment on his life." You mentioned that his press secretary had done it. And just you said, "Please let us mourn in peace." What were you thinking when you tweeted that? What were you concerned about?
It's so sad that I had to say that. But what I was really worried about was the press putting a microphone in front of the president and having him say something. And you know good and well, he would mess it up. He would start by saying something positive. He would then turn it into negative, and then it would all be about him. And I just felt like losing Mr. Lewis was so important. And I didn't want to see him disrespect him like I believe that I don't think he's capable of doing anything else. And the other thing that was very troublesome to me is that he called for the flags to fly at half mast for one day. No, if they need to fly at half mast until Mr. Lewis is put to rest. Yeah. And it's just those things. I mean, if he can't show empathy for the fact that we've lost 141,000 Americans, how would he feel empathy for, a person who the majority of the country views as a giant, and he does not. And we know this.
I mean, I want to ask you about the pandemic. You mentioned that, you know, this is disproportionately impacting people of color. It's preventing millions of people of all colors from working, sending their kids to school. We're hearing now the president doesn't even want to put money for new testing and the CDC into another bill. What more do you think Congress should be doing and the federal government broadly? Because I think there's a real sense at the state and local level that they need the help.
Well, you know, I think that what the president is trying to do is he's using magical thinking, which he does sometimes, that all he has to do is just wish it away. I mean, remember, he said, this is going to disappear. He's still saying this is going to disappear. And that's what hurts my heart so much, because, again, people are dying by the thousands every day. And the role, the first responsibility of the commander in chief is to keep us safe. And he has failed that terribly.
What more do you think Congress needs to do? Of course, the House has passed the HEROES Act with $3 trillion. The Senate is now thinking about what to do. What, how optimistic are you that something meaningful is going to happen?
I'm actually optimistic that it is. But you know what I don't like? I don't like that what happens here in Congress is we wait until people are suffering. Now, we knew when the expiration date was for unemployment insurance. Why do we have to wait till the last minute?
Well, let me just ask you, why do you think that is? You think it would be politically smart to get ahead of it?
Well, you would think so, but under Speaker Pelosi's leadership, we passed the bill over a month ago. It's just been sitting there. And I think, and I'm not really sure Mitch McConnell's thinking. I'm really not, because in the end, he knows he's going to do something. But I think he's holding out for a couple of things. One, I don't think he wanted to give people the extra $600 a week, because some people believe that that's enough to keep folks from working.
Even if there aren't jobs to go to.
Even if there's not jobs to go to. But yet, we can give $500 billion away with no accountability. They don't even want to reveal who has the money. And you're going to complain about individuals getting $600 a week? It's just, it is shameful how they don't believe in accountability if you're wealthy, and they believe in micromanagement if you are lower income.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with LA Congresswoman Karen Bass. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with Marisa Lagos, and our guest today is Karen Bass. She represents the 37th Congressional District in Los Angeles, which includes a very diverse swath of LA, including Culver City, Crenshaw, Westwood, and a whole lot more. And she also chairs the Congressional Black Caucus. Congresswoman, you are an LA native, and I think you grew up in the Venice Fairfax area of Los Angeles. What was your childhood like?
You know, my childhood was fine. I had two amazing parents that made sure that we were safe, we had what we needed. And I grew up in a time of tremendous change happening all over the world, which was the reason why I made a decision at a very young age that I wanted to devote my life to social and economic justice, very similar to Mr. Lewis. And I used to sit and watch the news with my father and saw the civil rights movement on TV and couldn't wait to grow up so I could participate.
I know your dad was a mail carrier and your mom had a hair salon. Did she give that up before she had children?
Yes.
Yeah.
My mom was a homemaker, and that was important to my dad because my dad grew up never seeing his mother because his mother was a domestic. And so he wanted his children to grow up with their mother. And yes, my father was a letter carrier. And so he used to wake up super early in the morning and I'd wake up with him and listen to the news on the radio because we didn't have 24-hour TV news.
We like that. We like people listening to the radio.
We do. Were they political? Did you talk about the civil rights movement as a child with them?
Yes, but my parents were anything but political. Another, similarity with Mr. Lewis, my parents did not want me involved in politics at all. They saw politics as being very dangerous, and they were afraid that I would lose my life because during those years, so many people were being killed that they did not want me to do that.
Well, in fact, one of the people you were supporting at the age of, I think, 14, maybe even volunteering for, was Bobby Kennedy, who was shot and killed in Los Angeles in 1968. Where were you when you found out about that, and what impact did that have?
I was listening to it when it happened. I mean, I volunteered in his campaign. I had signed up my mother to be a precinct captain, and I walked the precinct. And of course, I wanted to go to the Ambassador Hotel that night, but as a 14-year-old, my parents weren't having it. So I was laying in bed with the radio listening to him being murdered. And, as a 14-year-old, of course, I didn't think about it until I was much older. But that was a real traumatic event in my life and definitely led to a lot of confusion as to where you go from here. Because remember, just a few months before, Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And remembering the assassination of JFK, I mean, I was just 10, but then, what happened to a number of the activists? So there were people, dying around me. And it definitely impacted my life. But again, it's one of those things that you don't quite realize until you're older.
So you volunteered on that campaign you ended up going to Cal State Dominguez Hills for undergrad. I mean, were you imagining at that point that your life could go into politics? Did you, I don't know, just tell us about going to college. Yeah.
No way. I went to college much earlier than Cal State Dominguez. I went to San Diego State first.
Okay.
No, I was very much involved in anti-war activities and police abuse activities. So I have always, and I still view politics as much bigger than being in elected office. Being in elected office is just one sector, one arena. But being involved in community level politics is what I was always working on. I ran during the movement to free Nelson Mandela, the anti-apartheid movement. I was running one of those organizations. So I'd always been involved on that level.
The LAPD was notorious during those years in the 70s and 80s and 90s, even into the 90s. I'm wondering if you have three brothers. I'm wondering if they or you or your dad had any personal experience with the LAPD.
I had more personal experience than I want to remember, so much that I wound up being involved in a lawsuit against the police. You know, what the police did during that time was they harassed anyone that was an activist. And so, from... just basic harassment to slashing tires, to vandalizing cars, to, our police chief at the time fancied himself to be LA's version of J. Edgar Hoover. He had files on everyone, including the mayor, half the city council. People were dying of chokeholds. He went and had a press conference and basically said the reason why Black people died was because the veins in our neck were different than normal people. I mean, it took us, we fought against this guy for 20 years, for over 20 years, and we had to change the city charter in order to get rid of him.
How did then you make the leap into healthcare, which is sort of your first career? You've had several. Was that something that came out of that activism or just something that you were interested in?
Well, I was always interested in physiology and healthcare, but to me, it's kind of funny to talk about it now, but it never occurred to me that anybody would give me a paycheck to be politically active. But I have to have a job. So I worked in healthcare because, if you work in healthcare, you will always have a job. So I wanted to be a PA, a physician assistant, and during those years, you had to be in another field first. So I went to nursing school. Went to PA school, and then I joined the faculty at USC Medical School, and I was teaching, when the whole crack cocaine epidemic happened. And that led me to leave medicine and start my own organization.
If you're just joining us, I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're talking with Los Angeles Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass. And Congresswoman, obviously, you know, we're in the middle of this pandemic. You have a healthcare background. What did you take away from that earlier career you had, which was in the middle of the crack cocaine epidemic, the AIDS epidemic was going on? You know, what lessons do you take?
Well, you know, most importantly, and I was involved, I was working in the emergency room when this mysterious pneumonia that was impacting gay men started. And of course, later we learned that was HIV, it was the AIDS epidemic. And so what I learned is that when you face something like that, you have to jump on it aggressively. And it's the exact opposite of what we've seen here. And I just do not believe in any way, shape, or form that in the richest country in the history of the world that we had to lose 141,000 Americans. Absolutely. And I'm worried that there's no end in sight.
Right. So going back, kind of jumping around here, you mentioned you left healthcare to go into community organizing. You founded a group that really worked to try to make the areas of LA that you now represent safer. And some of that really came to a head around, you know, the beating of Rodney King in the early 90s and then the acquittal of those police officers and the riots that followed. Can you talk about, like, looking back, kind of what that sparked in you then and what similarities you see to this moment right now? Because a lot of the work you were doing was around building multiracial coalitions at a time when there was a lot of divisions in LA between the Asian community and the Black community, the Latino community.
Well, when I started Community Coalition in 1990, we started it as an African-American Latino organization. And what we were really trying to do, we were fighting against all of the legislation that was being put forward that we felt was going to lead to mass incarceration, because crack cocaine to me was a health issue and an economic issue, and we were criminalizing it. Now, if you fast forward to now and the people are out talking about police and defund the police, and I say it differently, I say refund the communities, because really it was during those years when they started cutting all of the funding to social services and investing all of the money in building prisons and jails. So we were on the front end trying to stop that 30 years ago. So I feel like here I am 30 years later, I have been fighting every day for the last 30 years. And I'm excited now because I feel like finally the change is beginning to take place.
You got elected to the Assembly in 2004. 4 years later, you're the Speaker of the Assembly. And then shortly after that, you go to Congress. And while you were up in Sacramento, not to skip over Sacramento too quickly, because you did help solve the budget deficit and work with Republicans, but you said to the LA Times, I think it was, when you were asked, how do men and women deal with power differently? And you said, I think that women are much more collaborative, men are much more competitive. And then you say, and here's the funny thing, I think men are more emotional. How does that translate to Washington?
It's the same thing. I think it's the same thing. I mean, talk about emotion. I mean, coming out of the White House, he's unglued over there. You never know what we're going to get from one minute to the next. But I came away going, why is it that we're called hysterical? Because I definitely found my male colleagues to be way more emotionally vulnerable. They just expressed it in different ways. And yes, I do think the gender dynamic is still there. So it's interesting to me because I come here and there's a woman that's winning everything.
You're talking about the Speaker?
Exactly.
who I think defines unflappable in a lot of those situations.
And if you think about it, you know, Mitch McConnell has abdicated his role. He's essentially decided he's just doing whatever Trump wants him to do, as opposed to, and we're supposed to be a co-equal branch of government. Yeah. We only function like that in the House, not in the Senate.
So I would have loved to spend more time on your time in the Capitol, state Capitol, because I was there covering part of the end of your speakership. But we need to talk about what's happening now. And I mean, you've been at the forefront of police issues, as we mentioned, for decades, but you've really taken a lead in recent months as the head of the Congressional Black Caucus and the point person on Democrats' police reform bill in the House. Tell us about that bill. You managed to get the entire caucus to come along and a couple of Republicans, and I believe it's now kind of sitting in limbo, right?
Well, it's sitting with 200 other bipartisan bills that are just sitting over there. I mean, that's kind of what I was meaning about Mitch McConnell. He just is not doing anything other than confirming judges. And so there was plenty of time to address the HEROES Act and the Justice and Policing Act. And so what we're doing now is trying to do anything we can to put pressure on the Senate so that they will take up the bill. But at the same time, you know, this is a real moment in history because, like you said, it was pretty amazing that all the Democrats voted for the bill. If it hadn't been for those hundreds of thousands of people out in the street, I don't think we would have even been voting on this at all. But I will tell you that a number of my Republican colleagues are talking to me very concerned about this legislation and wanting to figure out how they participate. So I haven't given up, at all.
You know, the Black Lives Matter movement is its image has been transformed by what happened with George Floyd and the multiracial protests. White people are really thinking about white privilege and systemic racism and that kind of thing. We still have the president initially calling Black Lives Matter like terrorists and anarchists. You're working with the only Black Republican in the U.S. Senate, Tim Scott, from South Carolina, on the police reform bill. How confident or hopeful are you? Because I can imagine he feels one way as an African-American man, but he's got this, you know, caucus of white male Republicans mostly.
Exactly. Well, I imagine it's pretty lonely. Although, you know, he's a really nice man. I hope to talk to him later on this week. And I think he has the type of demeanor that, I mean, and he would have to, that allows him to get stuff done. He has a good relationship with the president. He's well respected in his caucus and in his state. And so I know that he's willing to work together, and I look forward to working with him. We actually came in together. He was in the House first, and then he was appointed to the Senate before he ran.
So we got to talk about the elephant in the room, which is, you know, one of the reasons we brought you here, not just your police reform work, but you are rumored to be on this, you know, pretty exciting short list for Joe Biden's vice presidential candidate. I guess my first question is, like, what has it been like? I mean, you've been doing the rounds, talking to a lot of media, but it must be kind of surreal to be in this position.
Well, everything that is happening right now is so surreal in our country. And I am completely confident that the vice president is going to pick a running mate. First of all, it's very exciting that he has decided to pick a woman. And, you know, issues specific to me, of course, have to be addressed by the campaign. But it is a surreal moment. And to know that in January, now we're going to have to do everything we can to make sure that he wins, because I just don't know what our country would look like if we had to face four more years of this type of chaos. But I believe that he's going to pick somebody that he can work with well and somebody who can help him lead this country, because just think about what he's going to inherit. I mean, the odds are we could be in a depression by the time January comes, and there could be over 200,000 people dead. And then, you know, the president has ripped up our reputation internationally. If he hadn't, we might have been able to have a better manage this pandemic better.
Joe Biden, of course, is known famously for his empathy and his ability to relate to people who've gone through tragedy. And, you know, like Joe Biden, you had an unimaginable, really, tragedy strike. Your family, your only daughter and son-in-law, were killed in a car crash in 2006. I think they were both just 23 years old. And, of course, that happened very similar to Joe Biden. First of all, how did you get through that? And I imagine you're still getting through it, because no one ever gets through it completely. And did you ever have a conversation about it with Joe Biden?
You know, I've just had a small conversation with him about it. I do hope to get to know him and to talk about it further, because I think I can learn a lot from him as to how you manage the grief You don't ever get over it. You just learn how to manage and survive day to day. It doesn't matter. People tell you, well, in time it gets better. It doesn't. It doesn't at all. It just becomes a pain that you learn how to deal with.
Do you, I know some people on the left have been frustrated that Biden made the announcement that he would choose a woman on a debate stage, that it, you know, that it would have been more powerful maybe to just do it. And of course, we know that several of the women he's considering, I think the majority, are women of color. What, knowing that we've only had two women ever in our history nominated as vice president, what challenges do you foresee for any woman, particularly woman of color?
Oh, I think the challenges are going to be a lot. And you know what I think is going to happen? Because this happened to me as speaker. You know, there was a woman who was speaker shortly for a few months. And
Republican.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was always compared with her. You know, oh, is she going to last? Oh, is she just going to be a puppet? Oh, she's only going to be there for a few months. And I think the woman, and I don't remember her last name. I know her
Doris Allen, I think it was.
Yeah, Doris Allen, that's right. She lasted as speaker for a few months. And so until I got past that 4-month period, everybody compared me with her. And I think that whichever woman is picked, I think there's going to be the comparison. And that I don't think that's going to be a pretty one. But I think that is what is going to happen.
You know, there's sort of an irony in this moment we're in as we are becoming more aware and seeing all these videos of people who are confronting African-Americans with one crazy thing or another, watching bird, you know, bird watching in Central Park. And the meme has become Karen, the name Karen. And that's you. Your name's Karen. What do you make of that?
You know, the funniest thing was I didn't know that. My young staff told me that like about a month ago. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I saw that. So, you know, what I was thinking is getting a group of Karens together. I know a number of Karens. They're all African-American, too. Saying, wait a minute. We want to take our name back.
Take back the Karens.
Switch to Judy.
I like that. So last, probably final question. We noticed that one of the fun things you have done in your life is that you studied martial arts in your 20s. And I imagine that there are some lessons from that that you have brought to politics. Tell us what, I don't know, what are you still sort of vibing with around that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the reason I studied martial arts was to protect myself. I mean, you know, I tell that to young women now. You know, I didn't grow up knowing what the term sexual harassment, it was called handle it. So, you know, I studied martial arts to protect myself. And one of the things that you learn in martial arts is how not to fight, how to avoid conflicts. But if need be, you know, I'd have to hold my own.
When's the last time you threw a kick at somebody?
Many, many years.
I'm sure you've thought about it many times.
Yes. I have a list.
A proverbial kick may be a little different in Washington,
verbal,
I suppose.
Maybe a verbal exactly. Kick, maybe. All right. So, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say that, yeah, we were so happy to have you. And I think back to your time. I know Scott brought up the issue of, you know, being a woman. And I also read that you talked about always wanting to call on female reporters because of the gender dynamic. And I recall that in the Capitol. Are you still doing that in the nation's capital, trying to kind of
Absolutely. Yeah, especially if I find they're not, you know, they're being overshadowed.
And it's interesting that President Trump often gets into it with women, female, especially women of color.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just sad. He's a mess in so many ways.
All right. We're going to have to leave it on that note. Congresswoman Karen Bass, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This was fun.
Good. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Katie McMurrin's our engineer. KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Jonathan Blakely, and Erica Aguilar. I'm Marisa Lagos. Follow me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. We'll see you next time, everybody.